Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. When rookie FBI agent Mark Putnam received his first assignment in 1987, it was the culmination of a lifelong dream, if not the most desirable location. Pikeville, Kentucky is high in Appalachian coal country, an outpost rife with lawlessness dating back to the Hatfields and McCoys. As a rising star in the Bureau, however, Putnam soon was cultivating paid informants and busting drug rings and bank robbers. But when one informant fell in love with him, passion and duty would collide with tragic results. A coal miner's daughter, Susan Smith, was a young, attractive, struggling single mother. She also was a drug user, sometimes described as a con artist, thief, and professional liar. Ultimately, Putnam gave in to Smith's relentless pursuit. But when he ended the affair, she waged a campaign of vengeance that threatened to destroy him. When at last she confronted him with a shocking announcement, a violent scuffle ensued, and Putnam, in a burst of uncontrolled rage, finally, fatally strangled her. Though he had everything necessary to get away with murder, a spotless reputation, a victim with multiple enemies, and the protection of the Bureau's impenetrable shield, his conscience wouldn't allow it. Tormented by a year of guilt and deception, Putnam finally led authorities to Smith's remains. This is the story of what happened before, during, and after his startling confession. Revised and updated, this book also includes photos and a new epilogue by the author. The book we're featuring this evening is Above Suspicion, an undercover FBI agent, an illicit affair, and a murder of passion. With my special guest, journalist and author Joe Sharkey. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Joe Sharkey.
Hey, Dan, how you doing?
Thank you very much. I'm doing fine. Thank you. This is an incredible book. Tell us a little bit about how this was, when this was first published in, I believe, 93. Tell us how you came to be the author of this book, why you became involved, how you became involved.
Well, as you know, true crime stories generally are in the headlines. This one was not. Mark Putnam's wife, at the time, was desperate to get this story told because she was extremely frustrated with the way she thought the FBI was stonewalling her and trying to get to more of the truth about what had occurred. Neither she nor her husband, Mark Putnam, ever denied that he did it or the circumstances of it. Kathy Putnam, though, was just desperate to get the story out, and my agent at the time heard about Kathy and put me in touch with Kathy. And as I got to know her, I thought, this is really a remarkable story, a remarkable event. It was below the media radar because it had occurred in this very isolated portion of Appalachia. And I thought more and more, Kathy was extremely forthcoming, and her husband was available to talk in prison. And as I got, I spent some time in that part of eastern Kentucky, in Pikeville, and then farther east along the Tug River, where Susan Smith, the victim, had grown up in a coal mine town. And more I realized there's a lot of richness in this story. So I sort of just dug into it, and Above Suspicion was the result.
When, just as you write in the book, you take us back to this time, February 87, Mark and Kathy Putnam, as you mentioned, and this is his first FBI assignment. And so as you write in the book, in this small place, Pikeville, population 4,500, East Kentucky, and Susan Smith being directly related to the Hatfields, you tell us a little bit about and describe for us and set the stage for the reader about this area that has a great influence on this story. Tell us a little bit about this Pikeville, East Kentucky.
Well, Pikeville is the metropolis, as what was a 4,500 population, of the coal mine region in this part of eastern Kentucky, and which also abuts just across the river, West Virginia, you know, the coal mine area of West Virginia. It's
right.
traditionally been an isolated area. It's still fairly isolated. The interstate at the time hadn't come anywhere near Pikeville. I think now it's closer. It was a place where outsiders traditionally had come in to extract things, starting with the lumber industry and then of course the coal mine barons. And it was a place of up and down economy with the coal mines. By the time I got there, and by the time this book was set, a few years before that, everything had fallen on hard times. The coal mine economy was in its just flopping around and not doing very well. It's a place where I got very fond of eastern Kentucky, and particularly not just of Pikeville, but of the town where Susan Smith grew up, called Freeburn, which is right on the river, very much a coal mine town. It used to be a company town. Susan grew up in this environment of isolation, suspicion, but extreme family orientation, if you know what I mean. There were always people around her who basically put up with her. She was a remarkably complex girl who had dreams of getting out of that life, and never sort of had the skills to achieve those dreams. She was sassy. She was pretty. The picture of her that I have in the book is the only picture I could get, and it doesn't really, you know, do justice to her. She was pretty. She was sad. She was smart, although uneducated, and she was desperate to be something, and had absolutely no skills in order to get there. The area is one of the themes in this book is not just the isolation, but the critical importance of what I think of as hillbilly hearsay. It's an area where at the time, I don't know how it is exactly now, word of mouth was how information sort of got passed from one place to another, and word of mouth had a tremendous influence on the way this story played out, particularly on the fact when Susan Smith disappeared from her home and her family and her kids in Freeburn, Kentucky. The word of mouth helped to cement the idea that she had, as she had done in the past, that she might have been off on some caper, that she was involved in petty drug deals with some, you know, shady characters, as was her husband. And she had been known to disappear before. She always took care to make sure that her children, she had two kids, were looked after. It wasn't that she was a horrific mother, that she had no major mothering skills, but she did look after her kids. So she disappears, and the hearsay is that, well, she's off to, you know, Chicago or someplace in Ohio on a drug deal. And that accounted for the fact that it took months, maybe 6 months, for it to become clear to particularly her sister, who lived also in Freeburn on the river, that something was desperately wrong. Susan had not been in touch at all, and then the mystery began as to who were the major suspects in Susan's disappearance. And of course, as is always the case, the husband, in which this guy was a ne'er-do-well, but also a charming guy named Kenneth Smith, he was the prime suspect. The local cops had no crime to investigate. The county cops, so they did talk to him. They figured there were other suspects. There was a notorious bank robber, again a charming guy named Cat Eyes, who was, you know, could have been a suspect. Cat Eyes was in prison at the time, but the investigation, such as it was a missing person investigation, and it really went nowhere for months and months and months and months. Well, Susan Smith's sister Shelby kept pressing the local cops to get on with it, and Shelby knew one thing, and only one thing. She knew that she had never met Mark Putnam, the FBI agent, but she knew that Susan was always on about her Mark Putnam. Susan was Mark Putnam's informant. She was on the payroll of the FBI. She was helping Mark crack cases, and Susan told stories, and it was hard to sort out what was real and what was a pipe dream for Susan. And Susan told stories about her affair with Mark Putnam. Now, these stories were being told in far away, in 40 miles away from Pikeville, and people sort of shrugged and said, "Well, you know, that's Susan. Maybe she is, you know, romantically linked with this guy, but there was no evidence of that at the time." So eventually, Mark Putnam became focused. It became more into focus as a potential suspect in what at the time was just a disappearance, a missing person. It took Shelby a long, long time to knock heads together and get the cops, to get the FBI to sort of get on this case, because the FBI was horrified at even the idea that one of its star young agents would be involved in something like the disappearance of a girl. And that all finally, about almost a year later, started to become a more serious investigation. In the meantime, Mark Putnam and his wife, who was a very assertive woman, who got involved in the FBI's business very much in an office in Pikeville that was basically unsupervised from the higher FBI, they had gotten out of Pikeville on good terms, and Mark was, as part of his reward for being such a crime fighter in Pikeville, was transferred with his wife and two kids this time to the Miami Bureau, which was quite a prize. And in the Miami Bureau, as all this stuff was going on back in eastern Kentucky, Mark was a real Boy Scout, and his conscience really preyed on him throughout the entire year. He kept thinking, well, they're going to find out. But he didn't do anything. He didn't say anything until about a year later. He started making moves like, we've got to get this thing clear. And it all just came to a head a year later when Mark, through a series of machinations with lawyers and with the prosecutor in Pikeville, decided that he was going to fess up, tell them that he had killed Susan Smith in a fit of passion, and tell them where the body was. And suddenly, we had not a missing persons case, we had a homicide. And the process of getting Mark through that confession period struck me as very, very interesting, because the district attorney in Pike County, in Pikeville, was kind of in a fix. He was a really interesting guy. John Paul Runyon was his name, because he didn't have a body. He had somebody confessing to a crime that he had no evidence of, except the fact that the person had been missing. And he had to very carefully, step by step, concoct, along with the attorney for Mark Putnam on the other hand, a crime, basically, that Mark Putnam could that Mark Putnam would, in fact, plead to. Eventually, the crime was second-degree murder, and the deal was Mark had to tell them from Miami where the body was. Once that was agreed to and negotiated and put in place, the cops and the FBI were led to the scene where Mark had dumped the body, on a sort of a mountain ravine not far from Pikeville itself. And they found the body, and Mark confessed. And in Kentucky, first-degree murder is extremely hard to prove, and the best the prosecutor could get, and I talked to him at great length when I was researching this book, was second-degree murder, a prison sentence of 12 years, and Mark pled guilty, went to prison, to a federal prison, because FBI agents are thought to be at some risk if they were in a state prison. And that, in turn, ignited another controversy in Pikeville, which was a fair-haired Yankee boy gets an easy sentence. And so that controversy is still going on in Pikeville. To me, the overall thrust of this book, as I spent more and more time there and got to know Mark Putnam and his wife and the people who knew Susan Smith, is that it was almost a classic tragedy in that you had a hero who was brought low by his own hubris. Mark Putnam was driven. He was up, you know, he literally was a Boy Scout. He was a high school and college soccer star. He believed firmly in the FBI. That was his dream. His wife was behind him, pushing all the way. And this was really his dream, was to become an FBI agent. And he was a really, really good one for most of his time in Pikeville. He was cracking cases. Susan Smith became an informant, and she really helped him crack some bank robbery cases and things like that. He was looking really, really good until, of course, it all just collapsed on everybody, not just Mark, but on Mark's family, and, of course, on Susan's family and her two children. So that was the gist of my interest in it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back, as you do in the book, though, to create this entire scenario where this Boy Scout FBI agent really looked like he was at all accounts, he had a future, a really bright future. He was madly in love with his wife. They had children, and he was at this outpost. What you have in the book, though, is the complex relationship between his wife, and this is a person with a little bit of a checkered past as well, and a redemption in her life, and then she met her dream, Mark, and Susan Smith, and the relationship with his wife, Kathy. Because she became an ally of Susan, relating to her. So tell our audience about this relationship that developed that contributed to Susan falling in love. Tell us, as you do in the book, about this evolving relationship that contributed to this, as you say, tragic death.
That's a very good point. And that, to me, is one of the most compelling aspects of this story, is the two women, is Kathy Putnam on the one hand, Mark's wife Kathy Putnam, and on the other hand Susan Smith, the informant working for Mark Putnam. The setting is important in that this office was an outpost, is just exactly as you say. It was not supervised. There was one other agent, and he was a goof off. So Mark Putnam was basically operating without, in essence, adult supervision, if you know what I mean. Kathy, Kathy was a really aggressive, assertive woman who helped Mark in every way to become an FBI agent in Connecticut, where they both grew up. She involved herself in the FBI's business, because basically there was no secretary in the office. She got to the point where she was handling a lot of the business at the FBI office. I don't mean the investigations, but taking the phone calls. And she got to know, because Susan Smith had become so deeply involved as an informant with Mark, she got to know Susan. And the one thing that, I got to know Kathy very, very well, and also Mark, but Kathy was a helper. She was one of these people who involved herself in sort of not hopeless cases, but desperate cases. And Kathy fell in as a helper to Susan. And Kathy made it her business to try to put Susan on a better path. She kept telling her, you can straighten things out. You can get out. There's a way to get out of this situation. And Susan, for her, this was mostly telephone conversations. Susan, for her part, began to model herself after Kathy. Kathy had a bit of a checkered background, as you say, but Kathy had, as a young adult, had really cleared all those things up. Kathy was pretty, she was poised, and to Susan's eyes, Kathy was the frosty queen. I mean, Kathy was nothing of the sort. But Susan began to model herself after Kathy in terms of the way she spoke. Susan was cognizant of the fact that she, and I don't use this term hillbilly in any pejorative sense, but that she was considered a hillbilly. Susan tried to improve her grammar. Susan was always a reader, which fascinated me. And more to a great extent, Susan began to act like Kathy. And I don't know how that affected Mark, because Mark was thrown into professional relations with Susan. Kathy had no idea. And Susan told her that she was in love with Mark, but Kathy had no idea that Mark would ever get involved into a romantic relationship with Susan. But it was interesting how those two, I think of these two women as Kathy and Susan as orbiting around Mark. And I think to the extent that I could, you know, it being a nonfiction book where you have to be accurate, I think I got that idea that these two women were involved in this tragic orbit around Mark. And actually, when the movie was made many, many years, not long ago, the actress who played Susan, the dead girl, the dead coal miner's daughter, was Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones. And that on location, it became, Emilia made it clear that she really was driven to that aspect of the book in her portrayal of Susan Smith. And I said to her, Emilia, after I watched her work on location, I was a consultant on the shoot, I said, you've really brought this young woman to life, which is something I tried to do in the book. But I was astonished at how well Emilia understood all that and got the very interesting facets of Susan Smith. And she worked, Emilia worked day and night for 3 months on this movie shoot. But I think, obviously, I was not able to interview Susan Smith. I talked to all the people who knew her, and I got these various parts of her personality. But somehow, Emilia seemed to just synthesize all that, and she just nailed it. So I'm interested in seeing the finished movie when it comes out, and finally seeing Susan Smith almost in the flesh, if you know what I mean. But those two women fascinated me. Kathy was determined to get the story told. Kathy was furious at what she thought of as the FBI having abandoned her husband, in the sense that he wasn't supervised, that they kept pushing him to get more and more involved in these crimes, and that her husband was not a victim. She never saw that, but that her husband was pushed into areas that should have been supervised a little bit better. There was another agent in the Bureau who was in love with Susan Smith. He was a no-good guy. He was an Iago, and he didn't know it. And he kept needling, trying to get Susan Smith interested in him rather than interested in Mark. And Kathy just was determined to get this story out. And, you know, I talked to the FBI, and particularly to the FBI agent in charge of this after the crime became known, and they were very, very astonished at Kathy. They did the right thing after Mark, you know, at the point that Mark confessed, and they understood Kathy's frustration. She never let go, and there was basically nothing they could do about it at that point. But Kathy was right. And the FBI finally, you know, the FBI supervisors finally admitted to me and also to the record that this was a real mistake. This was a black eye for the FBI, not just the fact that one of their star agents killed a female informant, but that he had been allowed and encouraged, in fact, to keep that relationship going. And that was just trouble. And I think the FBI finally, you know, came to that conclusion we made a terrible mistake here in letting, in encouraging this guy to keep pushing and pushing and pushing, and in not giving him better advice about, hey, this informant is going to be trouble for you. You better back off a bit. So that was the precipitating event, was when Susan, desperate at this point, Susan was almost delusional about her relationship with Mark. It was a short-lived relationship. Hillbilly hearsay is that these two had this torrid affair. They didn't, as far as I can determine, and I've worked hard on this aspect of it. They might have had, they had a sexual relationship a couple of times in a motel in Pikeville, and maybe once on a mountain road. From Mark's point of view, and I, you know, I blame him for this. He saw Susan essentially in a transactional way. She was helping him. She was deeply in love with him. He wasn't in love with her. She saw him as the white knight, as the knight on the white horse, who was going to, you know, collect her and lead her out of town to a better life. That was a case that she was tragically mistaken in how she saw Mark. She, at some point in toward the end of this relationship, she thought she was pregnant. She had a pregnancy test at a local clinic that seems to indicate that she was. There's some dispute on that, but it doesn't really matter. She confronted Mark. Mark had come back to town for a trial on a case that he had cracked earlier, and he had to come back for the pretrial motions. She confronted him with the fact that she was pregnant, that this was his child, and that certainly made sense, and that unless he agreed to marry her and, you know, and carry her off, she was going to expose the relationship to not just to Kathy, but to the FBI and to the public, and that would ruin Mark's career. He suggested at this point, they had a meeting place up in a mountain part of town, away from prying eyes, because prying eyes were everywhere in this part of the world. They went to this mountain place that they had gone, this pull-off that they had gone to many times before to discuss bureau business, and she. I'm confident that this is accurate. Obviously, I couldn't talk to her. She precipitated a fight. She was a fighter. I mean, she was a physical fighter. If you crossed her in any physical way, she'd fight. And she precipitated a fight, which Mark tried to tone down. The fight over. You'd better marry me, and or I'll expose you. And here it became very intense at this dark mountain road, away from any eyes whatsoever, that as she was beating on Mark, he grabbed her around the neck and told her to shut up, and then lost it. He strangled her. This is from Mark's point of view now. I talked to him in prison. She sort of collapsed, and he realized, oh, my God, I might have killed her, and he realized that he did. And then he did something that I've never quite fully understood, although I understand it partially. The next morning, Mark was supposed to drive from Pikeville, where he had come back for this pretrial business, to Lexington, which is at least a two-hour drive away, to the FBI to an FBI bureau office in Lexington, to discuss the case that the trial he had been working on with some FBI supervisors in that area. So Mark, being, you know, the obedient and gung-ho FBI agent that he was, now had a body, and in a panic he stripped Susan's body, put it in the trunk of his car, went back to his motel in Pikeville, spent a sleepless night, frantic, and then the next morning drove to his meeting in Lexington with a body in his trunk of his car, thinking, never be obviously never being able to get that out of his mind, goes through the entire day thinking they're gonna see how frantic I am. Nobody noticed that. They may have thought he was hungover. And after the day's business in Lexington, mind you, with a car with his car parked and a body in the trunk, he drives back to Pikeville and drives up to another area that he knew in the mountains. That was actually a strip mine area. Finds a pull off. He knows this area very well, and in a panic, dumps the body into a ravine, and drives off back to his motel, thinking, well, they're going to find this body, and it's all going to be over. But then you'll have to fess up. Nobody ever found the body until a year later. So that always struck me as, first of all, horrifying that he drove with a day with a body in the trunk of his car. I talked to him in prison. He was very cooperative. He didn't try to make excuses. And he talked about that. And the reason I know how he felt is that he told me. And I came away from, you know, 2 days in talking to him in prison with the impression that what he said was true. There was no evidence that there was another part to this story. I was horrified by what he had done, of course, as was he. But I thought, okay, this guy's being straight. The stories matched up. Kathy's story matched up. A year goes by, and he's frantic with guilt. And finally, as he's in Miami, and he realizes the FBI, the local cops have got the ear of the FBI, and the FBI is beginning to look into this case with the absolute certainty that one of their agents could not possibly be involved. The FBI team that went to Pikeville basically came there with the idea, we got to clear this guy's reputation up. And Mark, sensing that he was being figured as a suspect, went to his superior in Miami, gave some indication that he was ready to take a lie detector test. Reluctantly, they said, you know, you don't have to do that. What are you, crazy? He did. He failed the lie detector test. And then the FBI started to be, okay, we got a problem here. This guy might be the guy. And Mark, knowing that things were coming to a rapid conclusion, that night told his wife that she had picked him up at an airport. He had gone for the lie detector test. Told his wife in an airport bar, or not a motel bar near the airport. She said, you know, obviously he was distraught. She said, all right. He indicated that it was a problem with Susan Smith disappearance. Kathy said, and I have this from both Mark and Kathy. Kathy said, they both had a couple of drinks. Kathy said, well, did you sleep with her? And Mark said, yes. And Kathy had no idea that would be the answer. Kathy was kind of naive on this point. And then Kathy, sort of almost like just being sarcastic, said, well, did you kill her? And Mark said, yes. And Kathy's world crashed at that point. Her world, her family's world, I mean, everybody had thought this guy was just Dudley Do-Right. Everything collapsed, and Kathy did her best to try to make sure that Mark negotiated at least as good a deal as he could. As I said, neither of them ever indicated to me that they felt like they were victims. Kathy felt that Kathy was furious at the FBI, but they both absolutely agreed that this is what happened, and that Mark never ever in my time talking to him said that tried to deflect guilt. He almost felt like he had to punish himself.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Joe, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Honey. Holiday gift giving is great, but overspending is not. Why spend more if you don't have to? Finding the lowest price is easy when you use Honey. Honey is a free browser add-on that finds the best deals online. You always get the best deals with over 20,000 sites such as Amazon, eBay, J.Crew, Sephora, Expedia, Target, Best Buy, and more. I used Honey to buy Above Suspicion, the book that we're talking about tonight, and I saved $2 off the $8 Kindle price, 20%. I was impressed again that every purchase I've made, I've saved significant money. Very gratifying to save money. Honey has found its over 10 million members over $1 billion in savings. Honey supports over 20,000 sites online, stores online. And Honey has over 100,000 five-star reviews on Google Chrome Store. If you're buying gifts this holiday season, then you need Honey. If you're not, you probably know someone who is, so do them a solid and tell them about Honey. Honey can make sure that you're getting the best price for whatever you're buying. It's free to use and installs in just two clicks. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/murder. That's joinhoney.com/murder. Now, Joe, we are just skipping over basically some of the incredible dynamics of this complex relationship that Susan finds herself in before, in this fantasy that she has that she will wrest Mark from his wife, Kathy, even though she's friends with Kathy, and he'll leave his children. And like you say, she's delusional at this point. But we haven't talked about the situation with her husband, Kenneth, that puts her in this incredibly vulnerable position. And then you talk about the tryst that they had a few times that had sex. Of course, Mark makes the incredible stupid move of not using a condom. And so he believes rightfully, or at least he believes that he could possibly or could likely be the father of this child. And when you talk about the car and the meeting, she is provoking him and he is provoking her with talks of possible abortion, and then he and Kathy taking over the child from Susan.
Well,
you talk about
really,
go ahead.
That was a really good way to trigger Susan, was to indicate that he was going to continue life with Kathy. I hate to use the word delusion. Susan had pipe dreams, if you know what I mean. She, I think it's important. You mentioned the husband and also the milieu that Susan spent her entire life in, a hopeless place, really. And Mark, this was important. Mark was the only man that ever treated her with respect. Mark knew how to treat women. He'd grown up, politically conservative, but he'd grown up in an environment as a kid and also, as a college student and getting into the FBI where you behaved well. You had some sense of courtesy and comportment, and he always treated Susan with respect. He treated her as a person of some worthy of respect. She was blown away by that. No one had ever treated her that way, and I think it kind of led to her absolute misapprehension about any future that she might have with Mark. And she certainly thought, well, this guy and I are going to get out of, and my kids are going to get out of this awful environment and go to something, a much happier life. So that was really important with Susan's misapprehension. Now, I talked to, of course, everybody who knew Susan when she was growing up, and that absolutely fit with their assessment of her. She had pipe dreams. She thought she might be an entertainer at some point, though she was apparently not a bad singer. She always thought that things were going to be better than they were, and she never really did anything to achieve that. Kathy kept importuning her, as it were. You can get out of this environment, but you got to take step A, step B, step C. You have to get yourself away from her husband. Kenneth was abusive. Kenneth's friends were shady characters. She's got all these other characters that sort of braided through her life, including Cat Eyes, the notorious but actually kind of inept bank robber. There were a lot of banks in this area at the time. No big banks had come into this part of Appalachia. That there were small banks in every town, and Cat Eyes made a living robbing these banks. He'd spend time in prison and then get out and he'd rob some more banks. Cat Eyes was always, if Cat Eyes had money, everybody, all his friends had money. He was generous. And he wasn't violent. He was just a kind of an antic character who robbed banks. And he was part of that environment with Kevin, and with Kenneth, rather. And Susan had the good sense to know this is not going to end well. So she kept flailing about trying to think, how am I going to get out of this mess? And Mark Putnam was the way out.
There was also the incredible lure of money. You talk about how poor this area was. So for the first time, Sherry could boast things, but also back it up with buying the things that she was deprived of when she was young. And also you talk about that this Sherry Justice and Cat Eyes and her whole entire family and Kenneth Smith, as this trial that Mark was fortunate enough to have Susan involved with, helped him build his career in the Bureau. This was more and more endangering her with her own family and people that had threatened her and had actually made their threats, turned them to beatings. So she was increasingly in a precarious, doubtful situation. Then she believed she was pregnant, told people she was pregnant, told people she was invulnerable and had FBI protection. And those are the kinds of things that she said to him, to Mark, in that meeting, that she was provoking him and provoked him to kill her, didn't he?
Susan helped Mark with a lot of cases, but the major one, Mark was involved in other investigations, but the major one involving Susan was the trial for Cat Eyes robbing a bank. And from the Bureau's point of view, and of course they looked at cases being solved, and from a distance they looked at these things. It was remarkable that Mark persuaded his informant, Susan Smith, to testify in this trial against Cat Eyes. Now, this is an area where everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everybody's family. And, I mean, this goes back and back. You know, grudges are held here. This, as you noted, is where the Hatfield-McCoy feud played out.
Right.
Exactly right there. And it's that kind of an environment where there's suspicion, there's an idea that you certainly don't rat anybody out. And Susan went public at the trial, and that really, that was the most, I think, the most brave thing she did, but also the most stupid thing she did, because she put herself out front, and that, of course, caused lots of, Cat Eyes' girlfriend, Sherry, a couple of, a bit later after the trial, beat Susan up, I think in Pikeville. But it also created an atmosphere where you had potential suspects when Susan went missing. You had certainly,
right.
you had criminals, you had friends and family of criminals. And when I say criminals, it's, again, it's kind of an antic, kind of, I don't mean to in any way justify the crime, but we're not talking people shooting each other in the head. We're talking bank robberies and drug deals and things like that. That kind of crime at that level, but you had a bunch of people involved in this in this area, and so there were suspects to look at when Susan disappeared, and Susan had created a bit of a local scandal by going public with informing on a bank robber.
Yeah. She also had that pressure right from her husband that knew that they lived together. It's very odd. They lived together despite the fact that he knew she was an informant for the FBI, and then he spread rumors around the Pikeville that she was sleeping with Mark and that he had some account of them publicly sleeping or having sex in front of a restaurant in broad daylight. So that kind of pressure, and then you introduce this, again, you call it like a slimy character, this FBI guy named Ron Poole that has the hots for Susan, is calling Kathy, Mark's wife. And then Kathy, like you said, she's a very interesting character, but she is holding back some information from Mark. She wants to get the hell out of Pikeville.
Kathy's desperate at this point. And Kathy arrived in Pikeville really ready to ready to accommodate herself, and she found that she was she had no friends there with the exception of Susan. And at the point we're now talking about, Kathy was desperate to get her, Mark, and their children out of Pikeville because she said the environment was just stultifying to her, and also had become terrifying as more and more criminals became involved in basically the family life, because there was no separation between her and Mark and Mark's work. So Kathy is very much a force here. Kathy's working very hard to get Mark out of town. Ron Poole, the FBI agent you just mentioned, is a real a screw up. He's a veteran agent. The reason Ron is in Pikeville is because nobody wanted to deal with him in more important offices. Ron, as you said, had the hots for Susan. So you've almost got an Iago character here, that he's just working, conniving, to get. Ron wants Mark Putnam out of the way. And Ron is pressing on Susan, pressing her, and she is aware of that, and she's terrified of Ron, and she's aware that if Mark Putnam is not on the scene, Ron is the guy she has to deal with. He had been wheedling Kathy, telling Kathy that Susan, of course, was telling everybody that she had this relationship with Mark, telling Kathy that Susan was going around bragging about her intimate relationship with Mark and making Kathy even more frantic. And Ron never knew anything really about this relationship except what Susan had had told, what he'd heard Susan saying. And he's almost a peripheral character, but he's just in there. He's just causing trouble that actually adds to the circumstances that make this whole thing blow up eventually. Ron was in there just needling Mark. Ron was the guy that told Mark that he'd showed Mark the clinic report that said Susan was pregnant. So Ron was a fascinating character to me, and Ron's idea was, Ron's goal was this. He wanted Susan. That was his goal. He was basically, he worked drug deals, but he was all over the place. He was just off the reservation frequently, running drug deals. Ron's most interest, the thing that interested Ron is dead now. The thing that interested him most was women. That was his goal as an FBI agent, was to just have women. And eventually the FBI sanctioned him after all this ended. And, you know, as I talked to Jim Huggins, the FBI supervisor on this case, who became involved very late in the process, but just went down gangbusters and into Pikeville. Jim Huggins just basically shrugged his shoulders in dismay at the role of Ron Poole in all of this, and just said that the agency should never have sent Ron Poole to this place, and they were just horrified at Ron Poole. He died 5 or 6 years ago, but he was a factor, and he was the one that was working on Kathy to try to get her even more frantic about getting out of town. So Kathy, being who she is, and Kathy explained all this to me in great detail over a long period of time. As I was researching the book, Kathy began to, on her own, make overtures to known criminals, because Kathy knew that if an FBI agent's family was considered to be in danger, the agent would be transferred, boom, right out of town.
Right.
So Kathy,
right.
in a very strange and almost perverse way, worked on one particular bad criminal, trying to get at least enough information that that they were in danger that would cause the FBI to transfer her and transfer Mark and the family out of town. That was all part of the weird circumstances that were playing around this fairly basic case of murder. But you had all these people that had different goals, that had no idea. There was like a bunch of trains that were coming at each other and couldn't see each other that finally just collided.
When you talk about this year of remorse and guilt, and then every time the phone rang that Mark thought, okay, the gig is up, and then he was getting, like he had volunteered, almost putting the noose around his neck to submit to a polygraph. That's
right.
Very stupid. But they said, yeah, that's crazy, because this would interfere with your promotion. So
right.
This is the odd, ironic stuff that was going on in that year of him thinking that they're going to find the body, that I'm going to have to confess, I'm not really good at this at all. He had covered up his wound on his hand with some lame excuse. But it's very interesting, very, very interesting how savvy and how strong and how supportive Kathy was when she found
yep.
out the truth. And then Mark again was trying to commit legal suicide by submitting to a polygraph. This is one of the most exciting and interesting and edge-of-your-seat parts of this book. Tell us about this meeting that was supposed to be and what Kathy does, which is instrumental in him not spending the rest of his life in prison, I think.
Well, Kathy, true to form, charges that we're now in Miami. We're now at the end of this horrible story, horrible event. Kathy charges when she realizes that Mark is planning to have this polygraph test. Kathy charges in to the FBI, and she now confronts the FBI guy in charge in Miami. Finds out that the options are fairly limited. She then, on her own again, because Kathy was always pushing. She basically beats it into her husband's head that they don't have a case. He's obviously a suspect, but they don't have a crime. They don't have a body. What they have is a missing persons investigation. So, I mean, the FBI jurisdiction, except it's one of their agents, is kind of limited in a missing persons case. That's kind of a local or state case. Kathy beats it into his head that he needs to get some good legal advice, and that obviously he has to face the music here. But there are ways that he can limit his exposure. And through Kathy's pressure, he does decide. They do decide to get a lawyer who then negotiates very, very skillfully. Negotiates with the good old boy, John Paul Runyon, who has seen everything in Pikeville, negotiates step by step. If this guy tells you, if finally, you know, it comes down to this guy will admit that there's been a homicide, tell you where the body is, and then this whole thing can come to a conclusion. But we need a deal. And they did work out a deal that Mark would receive 12 years in prison, which is a fairly light sentence. And John Paul Runyon, the prosecutor in Pikeville, is of course aware of the local reaction to when this whole thing finally explodes. He's an elected prosecutor. He's been around forever. He's aware that he's going to be on the spot for giving what may look like a break to this FBI guy, this Yankee from Connecticut who sailed in and murdered a local girl and kind of gets a break. So he was in a terrific fix. And I think, you know, he took me over this step by step, and he was always troubled, I mean, to the end of his life by the reaction to it, because as he told me he had no other choice. He had to get the best deal he could get in terms of being a prosecutor, and that was to have Mark confess, to clear this thing up. And okay, so he gets 12 years in a federal prison, and that's the best deal they could get. There was a lot of furious reaction in Pikeville to that, and I think to this day, you know, these things never go away in that part of Kentucky. To this day, there's a fury about that. And I went down back to Pikeville and Freeburn right after the movie had been shot a couple of years ago, and kind of re-researched a lot of these, talked to a lot of people who had been who were in the original edition of the book, and it's still very raw. It's amazing because it's now, what, 30 years later, how raw the emotions are over the fact that this outsider, this Yankee, got a deal. Now, Mark is out of prison now. He got out 2010, I think it was. I guess I'm not spoiling the story because in the epilogue of the current edition of the book, Kathy tragically dies of a heart attack at age 38. Now, I was in touch with Kathy throughout this process because she just became, essentially, after the book was published, she became in a way a friend, and I always had an ear to listen to her. And what I didn't realize, and I truly didn't, in long conversations with her on the phone, was that Kathy was drinking very heavily at the time. She was basically ruined. Her life was ruined. She stayed faithful. I mean, she still, you know, stayed faithful to Mark, but eventually her health went downhill, and she had a heart attack, and she died at age 38. Well, that's in the epilogue of the book. It's just one of the additional tragedies in this story.
You write, too, that she was so supportive. He was in a federal prison in Minnesota. What did Kathy do as a result?
Kathy became a prisoner's wife. She went to see him, even though, you know, Kathy was now had moved back to Connecticut to be near her parents, who were always supportive of her, but kind of frustrated by her. She did what she stayed with the kids for as long as she could. In a financial sense, close to the prison, but then moved back to Connecticut. She stayed in close touch. She was on the phone. The kids were on the phone with Mark whenever they could be. From Mark's point of view, Kathy was now here is where I have to reassess a little bit about Mark, because he became a little hostile talking to me about Kathy, that Kathy was she wouldn't give up on this FBI obsession, but I think he did realize that Kathy was drinking, something I didn't realize, drinking a lot, something I didn't really twig on. And he became, in prison, deeply frustrated and worried about the children. Now, that's a part of the story that I know much less about at this point, except, when it collapsed and Kathy died and the grandparents took the children and Mark is now out of prison. The kids are living, and they're of course adults. They're living in Florida. Mark is in Florida, and that's sort of just where things stand after 30 years after this horrible thing occurred.
Tell us about the movie and the whole attempt or the effort to put this on film.
That's a really good question, because the book is, you know, what's a book, 350 pages or what? And when the movie finally happened, to my astonishment, I thought this is never going to happen. Once they signed Amelia Clark, the thing went. And I thought, well, how are they going to tell this story? Because there are really two parts of the story. There's the crime, and then there's the other stuff that's very complex, including Mark's year of having his guilty conscience weighing on him. I thought, how are they going to tell this? And they did, you know, a movie is 2 hours long. And you know, I looked at, I saw the script, and I thought, okay, well, they kind of boiled this down. One of the hitches was when the movie started filming, in they had to shoot in Harlan, Kentucky, because Pikeville had sort of become a little spruced up, and Harlan, Kentucky, a coal mine town somewhat to the west of Pikeville, looked like what Pikeville looked like in 1989. So they shot there, and throughout it was a 3-month shoot. The director was Philip Noyce, who's an accomplished director, and of course the star was Emilia Clarke. Emilia was deeply concerned that she'd get Susan Smith right, because she was playing basically a dead girl. And Emilia told me she'd read my book a couple of times. She had it dog-eared. But she really, she was a really hard worker. She really tried to get Susan right, and I think she really nailed that. Myself, I've never been involved in a movie. I actually thought it was a wonderful experience spending time on a location where you have like 200 Hollywood people, crew and stars, show up in this little isolated town, and accommodate themselves to it. And I thought, this is interesting. You've got all these skilled people who are, you know, just they just show up like it's just like an event to them, and they make themselves comfortable. It was a dry town, a dry county actually, and so they arranged booze runs 2 hours across the mountains to Tennessee and brought back, you know, supplies and booze. And by and large, there was like one motel in town. They were all crammed into that. Some of the stars had houses that were rented, you know, nearby. Amelia and her assistant were in a house nearby. But it was like interesting to me how these people basically just got into it day in and day out. They start shooting at 7 in the morning or even before sometimes, and then wrap up at 11 o'clock at night. Nobody was complaining, and I thought, this is an interesting business. I looked at the... you know, when you write a book, you do it on your own. But when I saw the movie, and I thought, look at the collegiality here. Everybody is working toward the same goal, and that's a bunch of people involved. So I really enjoyed the movie experience, and I can't wait until the movie comes out.
When is the estimated time that it should be released?
When will it be released?
Yeah.
That's become tricky. The producers and the financial people, I think, now I'm talking out of class here because I'm basically, there's radio silence about this as regards me because I'm a pain in the neck, I'm a reporter. There was a trouble involving the release. The movie has been released, weirdly enough, in the Middle East, and in Turkey. So it was months ago, it was available at the, you know, the cinemas in Dubai with Arabic subtitles, and in Turkey where it was dubbed. And so the movie's been released in the Middle East and Turkey, also in Spain on pay-per-view, which is weird. Now there's no release date. I'm told it's going to be early in 2020, but we shall see. It's very frustrating, not just to me, of course, but to the people who worked hard on this movie, Philip Noyce and Amelia and Jack Houston, who played Mark Putnam. And one of the interesting characters was Johnny Knoxville, is in the movie.
Oh,
and
really?
On the location, Johnny was like the star in town. He was the one. It's just this tiny little town, but he was the one who was the celebrity. And Amelia, who of course has brown hair and she's, you know, unassuming and sort of quiet, they thought that she would be the celebrity, but she really wasn't. People didn't really recognize her from the TV series Game of Thrones. Was it called Game of Thrones?
Yes, Game of Thrones. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Johnny Knoxville was the guy everybody followed.
Yeah, well.
So I had fun. I mean, I really enjoyed the movie, and I saw. It's clear to me that they made a very good movie. That they had to boil the story down to something that was manageable in movie form. The screenwriter was Chris Giralmo, who wrote Mississippi Burning, and Chris and I have since become
wow.
pretty good friends. And I thought that Chris, under difficult circumstances, got it basically right. He and I went round and round initially, but then I realized Chris wrote a movie. I wrote a book, and Chris wrote a movie.
And he did a great job capturing what
you
had written.
I think he did, yeah. Yeah. And Philip Noyce, this big gruff director, worked day and night, and I was just amazed at how on his toes Philip was. When things didn't go exactly right, he just innovated. And it was a good experience.
Yeah. It is fascinating to watch an actual movie being shot, but also you had the privilege of being able to see the screenplay and then see how that screenplay plays out and how they deal with that. So that's that was fascinating, and I understand
that. You've heard this about Hollywood, that when they adapt a book, the writer of the book is generally not somebody they want to deal with once they get rolling. And
right.
It was unusual in that they welcomed me on the set. They were just as mm-hmm. cordial and gracious as could be, and they made me sort of feel like part of the crew. And I really admired Philip Noyce for that. Philip was just gracious, and the whole crew were, and as well as the stars. I felt like I was part of the process, and I tried to stay out of the way as much as possible. Once I walked into a shot, not knowing that they were. That they were filming, and I heard Philip from down the street cut, and then through his megaphone, "Joe, you're in the shot." And I thought, "Oh, boy.
Yeah, jeez." Now you cost him a bit of money. Yeah, very, very interesting. Yeah. Well, I think though too that I had predicted a few years ago that Hollywood has run out of ideas. So I think the thing that hasn't been mined whatsoever. Has been true crime and true crime books and from true crime authors. And so if you're going to look for a consultant, somebody that's going to advise on set, you might as well go to that author. And it really is a great package deal that person has given these filmmakers and done all that investigative work, so they certainly don't have to go back and do it. And then as the author and the expert on this subject and this story, they go to you, and understandably they get what they need. So, very interesting.
Well, I think they need to ascertain first that the author is going to behave, if you know what I mean. They knew that I was not going to cause any trouble. Like, oh, this is not my vision. I'm smart enough to stay out of the way. They know what they're doing. I don't, in terms of a movie. So that was a good relationship.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
This is a Open Road Media re-release, and this was originally in 1993, and this is a 2017. Tell us just a little bit about the revised and updated version, and tell us how they might take a look at your work. You have a Facebook page, website. Tell us about that.
Well, the book was originally published in hardcover by Simon & Schuster in, what was it, 1993. It was optioned almost immediately by the movies, and it's one of these tales where it took 25 years to make the movie.
Yeah.
Once that became clear, Open Road Media, a kind of a company that does a lot of republication of books that suddenly have come back into public awareness. They were. I've dealt now with many publishers. Open Road was just a delight to deal with, and they encouraged me, and I of course jumped right into it to add what I could to the existing book, and I did that particularly in a new lengthy epilogue. They were absolutely delightful to work with, and they still promote the book very effectively on. On Amazon, they have every once in a while they have a sale that you can buy the ebook edition, not the print edition, for whatever $1.99 or $2.99. And I'm like, okay, the print edition is it was a good experience. It's a good editorial experience. And the book is available, of course, on Amazon or wherever else you might buy a book. I assume it's in bookstores. And they get the new edition because that's got a lot of news. The epilogue, I'm very proud of the epilogue. Because as I said, I went back there right after the movie was finished and spent time talking to everybody in Pikeville that I had taught in Freeburn. And I thought, some of these people don't come out well in the book, and I thought, well, maybe somebody might shoot me here. But it's just this hospitable area, and people were welcoming and ready to tell me what they knew that they didn't know 30 years ago. So overall, it was a good experience, and I'm pleased with the current edition of the book.
Well, it's fantastic. Thank you very much, Joe Sharkey, for talking about Above Suspicion, an undercover FBI agent, and a listen fair, and a murder of passion. It's been an absolute pleasure, Joe Sharkey. Thank you so much. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Dan. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. Good night.